Welcome to the Plexus Institute podcast, an archive of our popular Plexus Call series. Plexus Institute fosters the health of individuals, families, communities and organizations, and our natural environment by helping people use concepts emerging from the science of complexity. Plexus Calls are made possible through the generous support of Plexus associates and donors. Visit plexusinstitute.org to sign up for our mailing list and to find out more about joining Plexus Institute.
Our guests today are Ward Maillard and Lisa Kimball, and we're talking about education and what it takes to make community builders. Ward Maillard is the founder of the Mount Madonna Center in Watsonville, California, and an educator at Mount Madonna School, which serves children from preschool through high school. He has more than 25 years of experience in education, and he helped create the Values in World Thought curriculum, which includes taking students to interview government officials in the U.S. and other countries, and also world thinkers such as the Dalai Lama and Archbishop Tutu. He has he's the vice president of the Sriram Ram Foundation, a charitable trust that operates an orphanage, school, and medical center in northern India. And his students have visited India and Africa. By the way, they have some fabulous blogs on their trips, which you can see on the Plexus Calls page on the Plexus Institute website. Lisa Kimball is an entrepreneur with more than 30 years' experience as an organizational consultant with business, government, and nonprofit organizations. Lisa is a skilled facilitator who's expert in using liberating structures and other complexity-inspired processes. As CEO of Metasystems Design Group and executive producer of Group Jazz, she supported the efforts of teams, task forces, communities, and organizations. She's on the board of the Organizational Development Network, and she's a former president of Plexus Institute and now chairs the Institute's learning programs. So, Lisa, would you like to start?
Sure. Well, this is a great chance. I'm excited about getting to have a chance to have a conversation with Ward. It's fun to do it this way, even though it's even more fun in person. I got to first know a little bit about Ward through another friend of mine who always is a great scanner to find interesting people and interesting things going on in the world. So this is a great opportunity, and education in its most holistic, large way of thinking about it is a personal passion of mine. So I was just before we started priming Ward a little bit to talk. You've recently had what's become a kind of very cool annual Chautauqua event where a lot of people who are thinking interesting things in this space gather. I wonder if you could start by telling us a little bit about what happened this year and maybe if there were a couple of juicy highlights, and then we can go back and talk a little bit more about the school and some of your other programs.
Thank you, Lisa. It's really always a pleasure to talk with you. And this is a wonderful opportunity to think. You help me think about what I'm doing. So that's always useful. We just finished our ninth annual Chautauqua, which is, as I mentioned, we stole the title from Chautauqua, New York, which was the genesis of these gatherings for art, literature, education, poetry, and so on. And what we did is we purposed it to thinking about how we can transform education. And we started it. Angeles Arian was actually one of our founding and inspiring members. And so she's come every year since we've begun. And Peter Block has joined us a number of years. And this year, Angeles and Robert Inchausti, who's one of my favorite authors, came. He wrote a book called Subversive Orthodoxy, which I always find one of those books that you can keep reading and reading. We had educators, students, administrators, and what I would call wild thinkers. And it's based really in dialogue. The idea is that the people who come are the show, and that the engagement with educators, where we actually listen to each other with real curiosity, becomes a process by which we engage ourselves in our moving forward in our thinking. I also find it very healing at times when to actually be listened to by people who are curious, you know. And so that whole process really develops intimacy and vulnerability, and that's the context in which we all get smarter. You know, this is based on Humberto Maturana's work, which is, I think, very seminal in this, which is the notion that we are intelligent and languaging beings because of what he calls the matriarchal dynamic, which is based in intimacy, trust, and cooperation. And I think the neuroscientists now realize that we all learn better when we're relaxed, vulnerable, open, and curious. And so so basically it's a context in which we try to promote that to see what we can learn. So that's my Chautauqua story in a nutshell.
That's a great story. And, of course, listening to some of those attributes like being relaxed, vulnerable, open, you know, that doesn't sound at all like what we observe in most schools and in most classrooms and most learning contexts, unfortunately. In fact, are kind of just the opposite. They're stressful and didactic and all the things that we don't want. So given that you've been able to create a very different kind of school, can you tell us a little bit about that, Ward?
Well, I'm part of what I would call a very different kind of school, and I'm very different even within the context of my own school, which I think is one of the things that marks Mount Madonna School, is that there's a great diversity in the way people approach learning. But I think the things that we have in common in the school are vested in things such as self-reflection. What I work on at the core of the Values and World Thought program is the development of discernment, with betting on the idea that if the students develop the capacity of discernment, they're going to choose well in life. And so there's an intellectual component to that. I think there's also an intuitive component to that. So when we talk about educating the whole child, I think there's a lot more in that than just the headline that you hear people talk about. And I often wonder kind of what that means to people. And for me, there's an intuitive sense, there's an inner life that everybody has, and that has to be part of the learning process if we are going to do what we call educating the whole child. So social emotional learning is part of that, but I think there's something even deeper than that. And it is vested somewhat in self-reflection, which happens in contexts of safety, I think. And I guess my core objection to what I see going on in schools right now is what I call fear-based learning. And that means that the consequences of failure are so high that we actually have the kids not telling the truth about what they do, faking it, you know, competing with one another. So one person's success is based in another person's failure. So you have a kind of a high anxiety situation where we know from brain science that that doesn't produce the best learning conditions.
Yeah, it's amazing how, in a way, I think everyone knows these things. But one of the things that people are frustrated about is they don't really know how to do something about it. What does it look like in 3D and when it comes to life? What kinds of things are different than what people kind of default into doing for want of knowing any alternatives?
Well, my disclaimer is I don't know that I'm necessarily right about anything that I do. And most of what I've learned has been a process of what I would call happy accident. So my students, to some extent, have been teaching me how to teach. And every year I make a plan, I go into the classroom, and every year they dismantle it. And thank God for summers when you can reimagine yourself and reimagine what you're going to try next. But There are some key elements that I think that we have to work on, and I actually think this is a collaboration between all of us teachers. In other words, I don't think I'm here to prescribe how somebody else should figure out how to do the job of teaching, because education is local and it's contextual. You know, everything's operating within a context. So the answer to most questions about education is it depends. You know, do you have first generation learners? What socioeconomic group of people are you dealing with? What are the cultural aspects of the classroom? You know, and the central question is, what are we trying to do? What are we trying to produce? Rarely, if ever, do I hear that question asked. So I think the number one thing, well, let me tell you a quick story. We were in India to meet with the Dalai Lama. And the reason we got to do that, this is our third meeting with him, was that we were developing a curriculum based on ethics for the new millennium. And so we went to present him with the curriculum. And it was obviously a fabulous, wonderful opportunity to spend a couple of hours with him chatting and showing him the work that we were doing and getting lots of, in a way, pats on the back for what we were attempting to do. While we were there, we had an interview with the former prime minister of the Tibetan government in exile, Samdong Rinpoche, who himself is a fabulous educator. And we asked him about values in education, and he got very quiet, and he said, well, first we really have to think about education. And he said, the Buddha said three things about the duties of a teacher. And he said, the first duty of a teacher is to remove the fear in the student. The second duty is to impart knowledge. The third duty is not to give up until the student has learned. Now, that reframes education, and I think in a very different way. So the number one thing I would say, if we want to create learning in the classroom, is we need to create a safe atmosphere for learning to happen. And so if we remove the fear, we're going to see an acceleration. The problem is that we are wedded to the notion of predictable outcomes, and we're wedded to the notion of certain measurable standards, which are really only about, generally, the retention of content and maybe the understanding of some of the processes in mathematics and those kinds of things. But generally, it's about giving back what somebody's given you rather than necessarily understanding it. So I would start, if we were going to start by talking about how to reform education, I would say how to make our classrooms safe places, physically, emotionally, psychologically.
You know, it's interesting as you were saying that, I was thinking that, you know, we talk about safety for the learner, but these days I think many, many teachers are operating in a state of fear in the classrooms, of being blamed for all the frailties in the system, for, you know, being besieged by everybody else's solution for what if they would only do this or change that, that would fix things.
I think that is a brilliant summation on your part. And I hadn't really thought of that, to be honest with you. So how does a person who's operating in fear create a sense of safety for the students that they're teaching is a very interesting question.
Well, a teacher I spoke with recently said that the parents of her students would resist the kinds of things that you offer, trips to foreign countries, because it might take away from academic preparation and test performance and college admission. And that's exactly what Lisa's talking about. How would a teacher address that?
Oh, I love your questions. I mean, that's so pertinent to the conversation. It is true, I think, that the greatest resistance to us experimenting with the learning process is the parents. And the irony is it's based on love. So the parents, of course, have something in mind for their kids. They're wedded to the notion that security and comfort are the best outcomes of education. And so we have an aesthetic in school And I speak of it, of aesthetics as what we consider beautiful. We have this aesthetic in school that if you do well, you're going to be secure and comfortable in life. And at one level, then that becomes the driving force, whereas I wonder what it would be like if we thought, if you do well, you will develop the capacity to serve your community and find meaning in life. But the meaning seems to be wrapped up in a metric that has to do with wealth and winning the sweepstakes or fame or, you know, whatever that thing is that externalizes what we're seeking in life. And so the parents loving their children, and this, of course, is how they were educated, are deeply concerned about their financial future. And so now the example I would give right now is that we've become obsessed with mathematics and science. And what the biggest push we get from the parents is around the math program and the science program, because throughout the media, we're hearing that math and science is what will make America competitive. And what happened to the humanities? What happened to all the things that we do when our basic life is taken care of? We always move to the arts. You know, that's the product of a civilization that's working. And so I think the parents with very, very good intentions naturally would resist any kind of innovation, because they're saying, why would you experiment on my student, my child? So, yeah, we have some built-in resistance in the system. And the only thing I can say is what I've been allowed to do is I've been allowed to color outside the lines. And then when the students come home from these journeys and the parents see what they've learned, they understand that a different process might actually be producing the whole, caring, intellectually alive, discerning individuals that in their hearts they also want to see. And so I think you have to find avenues in which you can do what I would call proof of concept, and then let people decide for themselves. But you know, there's not going to be one answer to the multitude of questions about education, because I say it's very contextual. So I'm not saying I have the answer. I have an answer for my context.
You know, one of the things that I think is a trap that we get into in education, and it's a similar trap in pretty much all our other endeavors, and I think of it as we're protecting against the wrong error type, if you remember from statistics, that, you know, people will say, well, how dare you, how can you prove that different way of teaching language arts or math or whatever it is, you know, can you prove that that alternative method is better than the regular method? And I'm going, well, no, I can't prove that it's better because we haven't done it yet. But what we have a lot of proof of is the current way of doing it is not good. Why do we have to keep doing something that is proven to not be adequate until we have something that somehow we can prove to be adequate? It just seems like a basically backwards way of thinking that gets us, that keeps us from innovating in all kinds of spheres. You know, sort of like we'll hold on to a mediocre or even bad thing for fear of going for something that might not work.
Yeah, well, which is deeply embedded in human nature. It goes to Kathy Dannemiller's formula, dissatisfaction times vision times first steps must be greater than resistance.
Right.
And so it starts with the dissatisfaction of a system. The problem that I have with that, and I feel a bit caught because it's so easy to postulate what's wrong with a system. And, you know, Ivan Illich, for example, in Deschooling Society, was brilliant in his analysis. But what was missing to some extent was what are the methodologies of transforming that into something different. And so I like to think about what's the vision that we want to live into. So Maturana, Humberto Maturana, who's a neurobiologist who's made a huge impact on the way we think about the world, asks three questions. What is it that we're trying to produce? You know, so what's the object of education? I think that's a conversation that we have not had enough. And I think what we're doing is living into a narrative that someone else has created about the goals that we have in education. And usually they're fear-based. Second question is, what are the processes by which we produce what we say we want to produce? Third question is, how do you develop the teachers to facilitate that process? And if we can answer those three questions, I think we can begin to move towards a reformation, not one person's idea about what we should do, but about the collective, and maybe even the collective that's localized, so we have a lot of different experiments going on. But one thing I have to tell you is that I realized at one day was that if the students in my classroom learned nothing of what I had to teach them, their lives would still be okay. They're amazing. They're amazingly resilient, you know.
Right, good thing.
I think the main thing is that not to damage them too much, you know.
Well, you know, one of the things you talk about drawing outside the lines, could you tell a few stories of some of the kinds of outside the line drawing? Because I think another, even a key assumption that needs to be challenged in this, hopefully, community cultural discussion is, you know, who the teachers are. So this notion is that there's just the people in those square rooms in the schools is probably way too limiting. And I know some of the things that you've done have gone way beyond that.
Well, first, I think if we acknowledge at one level that a student doesn't learn math, they learn living together with a math teacher. Student doesn't learn values. They learn living together with a values teacher. So what the kids are really learning in school, if we strip away our fixation on content, is they're learning processes of learning. And they're learning about relationships with power and social relationships with each other. And yet, we're completely focused on the content. So for example, because I am in a system that where I have a reasonable amount of trust, I've gone entire semesters without giving a test in the normal testing form, you know, where you have numbers on the page that you then quantify and say how the kids are doing. So one of the things that I did is when I thought about engaging in a dialogue on values, which is essentially what I do, and I do that through focusing on concepts. And that, of course, I owe a great debt to Bill Moyers, who allowed me to take some of his work and turn it into a curriculum. And so we're actually engaging in a dialogue around concepts from which thinking about values and ethics emerges. And so there's no right answer in my class. There's only the quality of your thinking. So that's a little bit outside the lines. I'm interested in how you think, how you write, how you speak. I'm also interested in how you engage with your peers in the learning process so that we move from competition to cooperation. Now, at the end of the year, well, the other thing, of course, I do is I take them on these learning journeys, which is also pretty radical. And we go and we speak with thought leaders. We also visit charities and we meet people who are very different from us, who may be living on the margins, to discover something about our own humanity with them. And at the end of the year, I would be happy to put my students, in fact I do when we come back from the journeys, up on stage to have them talk about what they learned, not what I taught them, but what they learned. And I'll put that up against any other accelerated AP course in the humanities, and have a sense that the kids have essentially accomplished the same thing without going through a grueling process that's rooted in, oh my God, what if I fail the test? because the real test is how you're going to live your life. So they can learn to be articulate. They can develop their vocabulary. At the same time, they can also be developing curiosity about others, and also to realize that it's important to know what you know, but it's also important to know what you don't know. And dialogue does that. And one of my students, who I'm shocked to be quoting, came to me one day and he said, you know, I like dialogue because you can change your mind without being wrong. What a perceptive comment.
So that's a t-shirt. We need to get that made.
So debate is about winning, you know, forensic skills, so on, you know, but dialogue is about knowing what you know and listening to what other people know, not with judgment, but with curiosity about why they think that way. See, I think that when you learn different processes and you're in different relationship to people in authority, that's what you're really taking away from the school. So the fundamental question is, how can you produce a society of creative, caring, discerning citizens if the institutions in which they're learning are not creative, caring, or discerning? So that the process of education needs to be the thing that we say we want to create. And in that, of course, is a discussion and a whole bunch of experimentation. And that's why this is a dialogue. It's not, I'm asking questions. I don't really have that many answers. I'm in the process of experimenting to find out what is true for me and the students that I teach.
Well, so many thoughts came up for me then, and I also want to start letting we have some other participants. If you press 1 on your touchtone phone, it'll indicate that you'd like to ask a question and make a comment. So anytime you feel like doing that, go ahead and press 1, and we'll hand you the mic. And in the meantime, some of the things that resonated for me, I love that phrase about in dialogue, you can change your mind without being wrong. I wish, as a resident of Washington, D.C., that would be an incredible, I think it's got to be a bumper sticker or something, that, you know, changing your mind or evolving in your thinking is not flip-flopping. It's actually learning and developing, and that should be something that we value as opposed to, you know, a form of heckling, which
yeah.
is kind of how it's been framed. That's just so true. And I'm also thinking, you know, as I recall, I just was reading some history of the public education system for another project that I've been working on. And, of course, here in the U.S., one of the big impetuses for our form of education had to do with creating citizens for democracy or people capable of operating in a place where they were going to need to make decisions and choices and operate as a collective and so forth. And this notion of being able to do that is very important. And I'm also thinking, though, that, you know, there are some things that it's useful to know in order to be an independent person and manage your money and various other things that you need to do. And I was very lucky to go to Sarah Lawrence College, where they had an interesting pedagogy where the content of any course, like the history course, was really considered kind of the grist for the mill, so that, let's say, if you were taking the history of Europe, you would end up learning quite a lot about the history of Europe, but the real purpose of the course was to learn how historians think and what kind of sources historians use and what uses that way of thinking to our current life and all of that kind of stuff. So it was really the order of discourse of history with a particular history as kind of the content. So how do you think about content in the draw outside the lines way of thinking about educating the whole person?
Well, I have to confess, I love my content. I am, you know, the work that Bill Moyers did in World of Ideas, these interviews that he did, I think is some of the most brilliant work that he's done, and God knows he's done a huge amount of brilliant work. But the concepts that are embedded in the questions that he's asking are deep, deep contents that affect the course of a human life, because how we see the world and how we respond to the world has a lot to do with the outcomes and processes of our lives. So what I do in my classes, first I want the kids to be articulate. I want them to use the language. And you only do that by practicing. And so I want them to develop their vocabularies. I want them to develop the capacity to look at an idea, have a point of view around it, and then be curious. So often they'll come in and they'll go, well, you know, I really didn't like this idea. And then I say, okay, good, you know, you've got an opinion. Now let's try to go back and actually see what the person was saying and see whether you actually agree or you don't agree. So there's a process there of intellectual inquiry that I think goes very deep. So the content is really an excuse for us to use our minds to develop our capacity of discernment and to go into things deeper. And so the fact of whether they remember the content or not, to me, is not as important as their capacity to look at an idea, have a response to it, but then to stay curious and go deeper. So now if we're talking about learning as a lifelong process, you're developing a style and a capacity for learning that will serve you throughout your entire life, which is, okay, you see things, you have a response to them, but what's underneath that? And what's the truth? So instead of looking for answers, we're searching for truth. And of course, truth is contextual, you know, so then you have to understand that when we discuss values, values are not objects. They're dynamic principles. They work in relationship with each other and always within a context. So it means that we have to stay awake. It means that we have to think more deeply. And then if we do, we can start to understand some things. And most importantly, I think we ultimately get down to the point where we understand the values on which our lives turn. So content, to me, is a vehicle for self-understanding, not an end in itself. Like poetry, you know, poetry is beautiful, but it's there to evoke something. Know, something deep in the human spirit. And so, you know, in the broad thing, when content becomes king and security and comfort become the goal, we establish a very small vision for our lives. And I think the kids are capable of living into a bigger vision that includes not only their own comfort, but service to the whole. That would produce a different world.
Mm-hmm. So have you, I'm sure you have, maintained relationships with students that have come and gone on? Do you have some stories to tell about what happens to them in their next phase, whatever that is?
Well, of course, we're all going to cite the ones that worked.
Of course.
And, you know, teaching is a process of delayed gratification, you know, so... Early in my career, a wise friend of mine said, don't expect any gratitude until 5 years after they graduate. In some cases, it's 20 years after they've graduated, if at all. But for example, I just had a student come back who graduated from 7 years ago. And she's been working in the southern Sudan, writing grants for people trying to do work in a war-torn area. And she realized at one point that she was working in some really dysfunctional organizations that were trying to do good work, and she needed to come back to Mount Madonna Center in a sense to retool. So the adult part of what we do, you know, she came back for a yoga teacher training program, and now she's in our yoga service and community program, and she's staying for a few months to work and learn in the community. And so I consider somebody who has moved in that direction, who also understands what they don't know that they need to learn, as a success. I have other students. One is up at Stanford, and he's one of the leading guys on global warming. Brilliant kid. I didn't make him smart. He was already smart. I asked him one time, I said, did anything I do actually make a difference? And he said, well, yes. He said, actually, I learned quite a bit from you. And I thought, wow, that's interesting. Because this kid's about four times smarter than I am. I have another one who took the program that I have to a charter school in Pittsburgh and landed it there, and now he's doing work in innovation. A lot of teachers out there, a lot of kids who've gone into teaching, a lot of what I would call public servants, people working for the good, and probably the other ones I don't hear from, the ones who are really successful and making a lot of money, I don't hear from those ones.
So what do you think would enable, if somebody is, you know, somewhere out in another school or another community and thinking, I like this idea of lots of small experiments, what are some of the things that might help them be able to get going and doing something if they didn't have the advantage of a whole Mount Madonna school or something like that?
Yeah, this is the toughest question that there is, I think, because some systems are very hostile to change, and I'm not saying that any school system is intentionally, I think every school, let me put it in the positive, every school system is doing what they can do to meet the standards of education. And when their funding is based on outcomes, certain measurable outcomes that care nothing for local conditions, my heart goes out to them. And the administrators who are much maligned, you know, are simply trying to keep the ship afloat. And the teachers who get blamed for the failures are under impossible working conditions, trying to produce miracles. So what's a strategy when you have that kind of stress on the system? So I think you have to, in some ways, I say when going through a dark place, hold hands. I think you have to start conversations. I think you have to start dialogues about what matters to you. You know, and then I think you have to figure out how to engage the system in small ways. And, you know, I can't tell other teachers what to do. You know, everything is local. Everything is what's happening in the classroom and your response in the moment. But I can say that if you can't do a big thing, do a small thing. And at the very, very minimum, you have to love your students. Otherwise, I think teaching is too painful a profession. You have to care about them and love them even though it hurts. And that you try to see their humanity and try to see their gifts and try to give them confidence. So if you can't do anything from a structural standpoint and you just have to get through that syllabus, then your humanity is going to be the most profound thing that those kids learn in your class. And everybody knows that there was always a teacher somewhere that noticed you as a human being, that cared about you, that believed in you, and gave you confidence. And so it really doesn't amount to us having to change the system. It has to do with us finding it within ourselves to be able to engage with our students, not as a category, but as human beings, to see them. And I also at the same time know how tough that is for teachers who are overwhelmed with too many students, difficult working conditions, and Lord knows some of them operate in combat zones.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's totally unfair for me to prescribe other than what, you know, even in my world, I get to do what I want. Nobody tells me what to do. I have no limits on myself but me. And all my failures are my own. That's the problem. And so I find it very, very hard when I don't seem to be succeeding. And it's a very painful process to teach and not feel like you're getting what you want to get across. So we have that in common. But I'm operating under the best of conditions. What I really want to do is I want to engage and partner with the teachers who are working under different conditions and try to understand what their context is, and then be in dialogue with them so that they can actually see where their own steps are rather than having somebody come from outside and say, this is what you should do. Each of us has to find our own way, you know, because we don't want to colonize others even with good intentions. What we want are our independent people making choices and taking responsibility for their choices. So my heart really goes out to all teachers. I have no critique of the teachers at all. I think they're doing their best. But the question is, could we be in a conversation that might help us see our way forward to whatever the specific issue is that we're dealing with that's right in front of us? Then could we partner with the administration to try to find our way through? And at the end of the day, if we could find a way to begin to partner with the families, because, boy, I tell you, they come in with war paint on if they don't think their kid's getting what they need to succeed. And I don't think that's a very conducive atmosphere towards making the schools better.
You know, one of the things that I've been thinking a lot about, and it's one of the things my friend Louise Van Rijn's been working on a lot in South Africa, is this notion of the school's role in community beyond the obvious stakeholders of the teachers and administration and students and parents. But for example, here in my community in D.C., I don't have any kids in the D.C. schools, but what goes on for kids in the schools around here is relevant and important for me because, you know, they're the people in my community. They're growing up to work here and move around the community and be here. And there's very few channels or mechanisms for people who don't have an obvious connection to the schools to participate as a community task or community subject. And I would love to imagine how it might be possible that schools could have a different role in the community beyond just what was going on for the families directly involved.
Well, I know Louise, and she's brilliant, and her work in South Africa is brilliant because they have our problems, you know, to the power of two or three or more. They don't have nearly the resources. And what she's done is she's partnered people in the business community with the administrators and leaders of the school to create a kind of a mentoring program where they actually have somebody who can listen to them and mentor a way of reimagining the systems that they're, the school systems that they're managing. And there's this one man down there named Andre, and I've been out to some of his schools with my students, and they're doing amazing work. And so, you know, I think what Louise is doing is brilliant. The other thing I'd say is one of our Chautauqua principals is Vivian Wright, who's an internal consultant for Hewlett-Packard. And what she's been saying to me is she said, you know, when these kids come out of college that we hire, they actually aren't that useful to the company, and we have to retrain them. We have to detrain them and retrain them in order for them actually to be able to work for the company in the way we need to work for them. So the irony is, even if we're talking about producing people for industry, that the processes that we're doing aren't producing the kind of people that industry actually needs or wants. And I'm not sure if I would bet my educational career on doing that, because I'm not sure I agree with everything that industry is doing. But I'm just saying that even if we say we're producing people for the workforce and we don't have creative thinkers who have the capacity of discernment, who are self-motivated, then I think we're not even rendering unto Caesar what is Caesar's. So
I think that's a big challenge we have, is how, you know, you talk about drawing outside the lines. The lines are kind of the problem all around, because one of the things I love about what Louise is doing is that the relationship between the private sector people and the school administrators is a peer-to-peer kind of relationship, in contrast to a lot of programs where you know, the person from the business community is the person who's supposed to know how to do everything, and they will then tell the person in the school, you know, how to be more whatever it is they think business people are more. And instead, the notion is that they're peer learners where they can, you know, both maybe have a conversation about engagement that might benefit the business as much as it benefits the school. And I really like that idea. And from what Vivian said, it would be, you know, where is the conversation happening where we're all talking about what are the skills, what are the capacities we need in our community, in our organizations, you know, writ large, and how can we together figure out how to end up with people with those capacities, not just by doing something particular to them in a building called school, but, you know, in something that's a much larger way of thinking about it. So I think that would be, that's a very interesting conversation. It would be great to figure out what it would take to catalyze those kinds of conversations happening, as opposed to why aren't you doing this?
Yeah, I agree. I agree completely.
What did Vivian say had to be unlearned?
Well, I think when you have, you know, one of the things, when you have a fear-based learning system, and I'm sorry, I don't want to blanket everything with that, but when you have a competitive, high-stakes learning system, you know, then what you get is generally obedience or rebellion. And so somebody who comes in as obedient, looking for someone else to tell them what to think. And the rebel, we know, because that's who we were, we're hard to handle, right? So there's another thing that maybe is a little bit deeper, and I sort of hesitate to go there, but it's something that's really at the core of my thinking these days. And that is that school, I think, can be dehumanizing. And by dehumanizing, I mean we objectify the students. We use a kind of a threat. You know, if you don't get good grades, you don't get into college, you don't, et cetera, et cetera. So, and if you make a mistake, this is going to be extremely serious, and your life maybe will end as you imagine it to be. That you need to compete with each other for a few spots in the top colleges. You need to assimilate information faster than a human being can assimilate it. You know, so there's a whole range of things. You need to be confined to a classroom for X number of hours a day and be talked at. These are somewhat dehumanizing, and I had the epiphany the other day that if you take someone's humanity from them, then they expect something in return. And this is where entitlement comes from and where greed comes from. It's the only thing I could used to explain how the most educated people in this country were able to crash our economy with impunity and feel justified in doing so. And so I think one of the big problems is that when somebody has gone through that process, they have a sense of entitlement. And that, I think, is also hard in a corporate setting, because what you really want are, you want motivated individuals who are contributing to the well-being of the company community. And otherwise you get people who are there, what's the best salary I can take, because God knows I've worked hard enough to get there, you know, and what do I get, as opposed to what can I do? And I think you get a very odd mix when you put people through a system where there's a constant threat that if you make a mistake, and the other thing about making mistakes is that's how we learn. So if a mistake is going to cost you your career, you're going to either cover it up or you're going to figure out how to please the person so that you're giving them what they want. I don't think that produces the citizens you need for a democracy or a business. I don't know. Does that explain it at all? I don't mean to ramble so much, but this is one of those things I have a lot of fire for.
Well, you know, I think what's interesting is that this is why we need to have the dialogue, because I think we, you know, in the larger idea of we, including me and you and everybody, have a lot more thinking we could do about what it really takes to have the capacity to have a fulfilling life and be a contributor to the community. Because we're so bombarded with messages about what's desirable and, you know, what's achievement and what we should want or what we could want or what we could have. And I think most people have not had much ability to have the kind of reflection that is required to get to some of the insights that you're talking about, Ward, to think, oh, you know, here is what really makes me happy. Here is what I really do want, much less what you want for other people who might be candidates to work in your company or people to be your neighbors or, you know, whatever else it is. And it's kind of one of those things, we just never talk about that. And that's the question, why don't we ever talk about that?
That's a good question. And, you know, when we were just in South Africa and we went out to Botshabelo Children's AIDS Village. And so my students spent the day with 200 kids who were either infected or affected by AIDS. And we had taken a whole bunch of stuff down there, you know, medicine, clothing, art supplies, solar, all kinds of things down there. But the real power of our being there was discovering how much we cared about these kids who previously were simply something that was an abstraction, people with AIDS. But when you hold a child in your arms and you see their humanity, you feel their heart beating, it changes something in you about what your responsibility as a human being might be. And so the transformation of consciousness happens through experience. And so I think schools need to be looking at a more experiential modality so that the kids, because you learn from experience. And, you know, when I take these kids on these trips, I don't know what they're going to learn. I just know that they're going to learn something, and they're going to learn what they're ready to learn. And what I've discovered is that the learning is exponential. And when they come back and tell us what they've learned, you can hardly, you know, it's so amazing how they connect the dots and put things together. You know, so this process of engaging with one another and reflecting and learning what and talking about what we actually know as a society to be true might begin in a soft way without critique or blame, start us on rethinking what the proposition is for this precious thing we call a human life that doesn't last very long. And whether we have an obligation to those who come after, and whose shoulders are we standing on now to be where we are? And I, you know, at the root of this, ever since I was a kid, I always wondered, you know, what was the possibility of America given our wealth and our comfort and our capacities? You know, and in some ways, it seems to have turned inward. In a way where we're saying I don't have enough, and yet so much of the rest of the world has so much less. But what we discovered is that when you go and you give something of yourself to others, you experience what I think is the most beautiful feeling in life, which is joy. And so why is that such a secret? And it's the same thing with the people that Louise is working with. Those business leaders are getting as much or more out of the interchange with the school as the schools themselves, because they're contributing to something greater than themselves. So we did this initial project with the Dalai Lama called Project Happiness, and we spent a year interviewing famous, near famous, and unknown about what their idea of lasting happiness was, and it came down to two fundamental things: relationships and serving a cause greater than yourself. Now, where's that in the pedagogy of our schools?
You could talk about a basic. Yeah, that's really powerful.
You know, so I'm not, you know, I'm not a reformer in that sense, and I'm not, I guess my thinking maybe is a little bit strange, but I, you know, this is why I love Robert and Chausey's work, Subversive Orthodoxy, because there's a fundamental principle is the orthodoxy is always the what is, and yet we always have to be reforming and rethinking in order to move forward. Because what is going to be co-opted in some way. It's going to be the status quo. And change is always going to be an anathema to the status quo. And yet change is one of those inevitable truths of life. How do we get ahead of the change? Because we've been dragging our heels now for a long time around the GNP being the thing that we will measure the country by. And I think there are other forms of wealth that we could have that would be a lot less impactful on the environment and the social order, you know, if we could just rethink it, stand back from the question and think about what brings meaning to a human life. You know, and everybody gets it. Everybody gets it. Everybody's looking.
You know, I think that that experience of having conversations around those kinds of questions it's such a fabulous way to learn. I'm thinking of some of the, you know, wonderful documentaries that they've made of couples that have been married for 50 years or, you know, other people who've managed to do something that is very positive and they feel good about it. And just hearing people talk about it is so much more enlightening than the PowerPoint presentation about a bunch of factoids. I love the sound of that. Well,
yeah.
We're getting very near to our last minute. Prusha, would you like to tell us about anything upcoming before we close?
Well, thank you very much. This has been a wonderful conversation. Ward, I love your thoughts on preserving and not damaging humanity in kids. Our next Plexus call will be October 23rd. Please join us, and our guests will be Dan Peschet, Rick Smyer, and Robin Cates, and they will talk about complexity leadership and communities of the future in a new project that's underway in Asheville, North Carolina.
Can I just say
thank
you, Lisa, for the opportunity just to figure out what I think about things.
I'm glad you're a fellow one where I don't know what I think until I hear myself talking about it. So I love these opportunities to have conversations. So thank you so much for joining us, and I can't wait for the next one.
All right. Well, bless your heart, and thank you so much for all your great work.